You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome to episode 1 in the weeds, where we look at weed and vegetation management across Tamaki Makaurau. This episode is proudly brought to you by 95BFM for the love of bees, and very kindly by Michael Leck Gallery. This is the second sub-episode of our first topic, glyphosates and weed management in Aotearoa, where we will discuss what glyphosates actually are and what their place is, both globally and in Aotearoa.
I've been researching glyphosate for a long time, and I worked with Stephen Browning to produce a glyphosate paper in 2017 asking about why, you know, the EPA didn't really look at public health needs when they did a review on the potential for glyphosate to cause cancer. What we saw back then with the EPA was that they only looked at really the industry data to find out whether glyphosate caused cancer. And when people talk about glyphosate probably causing cancer or causing cancer, that started when the International Agency for Research on Cancer did an assessment, and they found that glyphosate and the glyphosate formulation probably caused cancer, and it definitely caused cancer in the laboratory rodents. So we have this kind of understanding that this is the IARC, the WHO IARC. What we're also seeing is the risk for glyphosate has been uncovered in the court cases in the States. And the judge recently found that glyphosate, the evidence for glyphosate causing cancer is stronger than the evidence for glyphosate not causing cancer. And when the judge stated this because sort of Monsanto said, oh no, all the regulatory agencies saying that glyphosate isn't a problem when used safely. And the judge said, well, I think that the data used by the regulatory agencies is now sort of smaller than the evidence out there in the scientific literature. And that was what a lot of the sites was used when they were analysing glyphosate. Now, of course, I should just quickly say glyphosate is a herbicide. It kills weeds. It's systemic, so when you spray it on the weed, it goes into the root and it kills the root. So a lot of the herbicides that are less harmful don't have that systemic action. Now, one of the big problems with glyphosate is that it has a very long half-life. It has what's called a DT50, and that's the time taken for half of the initial amount sprayed to degrade. That could be 143 days or longer, and that's for glyphosate, and it could be 514 days for the metabolite, the breakdown metabolite called AMPA. But this 143 days concept is quite compelling when you think about this being sprayed alongside a street or alongside a road where children are walking home from school. So, and the formulation is much more toxic than the active ingredient. They're finding different toxicities for different reasons, but we're now seeing toxicity for the neuroendocrine system, the brain, microbiome. We're seeing toxicity for reproduction, fertility for glyphosate. But the New Zealand Environmental Protection Authority, that's different from the US Environmental Protection Agency. So there's there's lots of different regulators. So there's a US EPA, which is an agency, and there's a New Zealand EPA. So our New Zealand EPA we cannot find a single risk assessment that has ever been undertaken. They did a cancer review 2 years ago, or three, or five, 4 years ago. They've never conducted a risk assessment. So when you look at the length of time it lasts in soil, and you look at the obligation, so under the Local Health, Local Government Act, bylaws must protect public health and safety. Under the Health Act, it is the duty of every local authority to improve, promote, protect, and public health. That's section 23. And Section 92 of the Health Act is when these authorities are exercising their powers, they must take into account special circumstances and vulnerable people. So when we have a herbicide that could last for 4 days, or it could last for 140 days, but we don't know because the local authorities have never conducted soil tests to understand that, or if they have, they've never published them. I think we have a situation that is deeply problematic, and we should caution the principle.
We may not be able to answer this one, but is there a reason or rationale as to why this information either doesn't exist or why it isn't publicly available?
So the New Zealand EPA relies on the findings of overseas regulators, such as the US EPA, the World Health Organization, and the Food and Agriculture Association. They have a group called the JMPR, and the WHO and the FAO looks at data supplied by the chemical industry. The US EPA tends to look at data supplied by the chemical industry. Now, that chemical industry data might be supplied, that is supplied, could be an independently published piece of scientific literature, but it's been selected by the pesticide or the chemical corporation. Now, the European regulators, the European Food Safety Authority, they've also conducted deeply problematic risk assessments, but they are our, dare I say, great white hope. If the New Zealand EPA followed EFSA tomorrow, we would all of a sudden have, you know, between 20 and 50 compounds that are already banned in Europe, not in our waterways today. So Europe is ahead, and they're going to conduct a risk assessment in another couple of years. The reason New Zealand hasn't conducted risk assessment is because it's expensive and it's very onerous and it takes a very long time. And so that's why historically they've just asked the chemical corporations to supply the current data, that and they don't risk assess. What they say is they reauthorize. So when a new chemical mixture comes in, they'll supply the data supplied by the industry, and that's reauthorizing. So they've never conducted a risk assessment, and they've only conducted one cancer review, which looked at the European science, and that was heavily criticized by New Zealand scientists in a 2018 New Zealand Medical Journal paper.
The other thing I think is worth mentioning is that it's actually an antibiotic, right? What it does do is it kills microbiology. You know, that's an antibiotic, killing microbes. And one of the microbes that it's really effective on is lactobacilli, which is actually a microbe in your gut and in the gut of bees and gut of animals that enables us to actually digest and process food so that we extract nutrition from it. One of the really terrible things about having it in the food chain, but also in the ecosystem that we move through, is that we end up compromising particular microbe that is critical to our capacity to absorb nutrition. That's that eating a lot and starving.
And there's many pathways, I think, they're understanding that glyphosate is problematic. So the shikimate pathway, which is a plant-based pathway in the microbiome, is harmed. And that's, you know, very important for synthesizing enzymes. Glyphosate is deeply problematic. The trick is, the question, Oscar, is when is there enough science for them to conduct a reassessment? Because right now they say there's not enough science to change our minds to conduct a reassessment. Well, the increase in publications that are about glyphosate, looking at the risk of glyphosate at the endocrine, at the hormonal level, which is an environmentally relevant level that we're exposed to in the environment. The studies that are coming out are amazing, but apparently just not enough data to incur a risk assessment.
There are some parallels between this and perhaps the cannabinoid discussion as well. And another question that comes up within that discussion, which I think is rather relevant here, and you touched on it briefly, is who is or what is the authority on chemical practice in Aotearoa?
That would be the chemical practice. So, you know, chemical risk assessment is the Environmental Protection Authority. But I would say work safe, guys. What do you, you know, I mean, sorry, of course, the formulations come through the Ministry for Primary Industries. The Ministry of Primary Industries, in theory, look at the risk of the formulation, and they are the ones that approve of the labels. So, you know, MPI work very closely with the EPA in this regard.
When the World Health Organization changed the categorization of glyphosate to a probable carcinogen, the APVMA did their own review. Now, the World Health Organization, International Authority for Research on Cancer, when they did their review, they had 16 scientists, specialists in their fields, look at over 270 scientific reports to come up with a weight of evidence based on their reclassification to probable carcinogen. Now, the way that Australia or the Australian authority did their review was to say, well, they've said glyphosate and cancer. So they went through the 270 research reports and discarded anything that included the additives to glyphosate. So Roundup, put it to the side, wasn't reviewed. Only the studies that that were specific about glyphosate were left in the bundle to that they considered required review. And then if it was for anything other than cancer, so anything endocrine was removed out of the list. And then if it was anything other than people and cancer, so anything environmental, toxicity fish, toxicity to habitat was removed out of the list. And they got it down to they got it down to 16. So the Australian APVMA, and this is on their website, this is how they structured it. So they only did a review on 16 of the 270. And they didn't have 16 scientists, they had one. I have not been able to identify who that one person was, but it was just one person. So it got down to one person's review of 16 of the scientific reports.
Yep.
And then they changed what the agencies do is they go on a risk-based assessment rather than a weight of evidence. So they said, well, if an operator wears and follows the labelled instructions, then the risk of getting cancer from their use of glyphosate is not zero, but is, you know, drastically reduced. Now, that was enough for them to say that if you follow the labelled instructions, that you won't get cancer. Okay, what the APVMA didn't do was follow their charter, which was to protect the well-being of the people and of the environment. They narrowed their report down to whether operators who are exposed to this every day, if they use the necessary precautions as per the label, whether they would get cancer. So that was enough for all the councils here to say, well, the APVMA say it's safe to use, and for the for all the hardware stores to say, well, the APVMA doesn't agree with the World Health Organization, so therefore business as usual.
Yeah, look, Jeremy's made a really important point. The weight of evidence issue has been, you know, tossed around in New Zealand as well. So in Europe, if something is found to be a carcinogen, this is why it's such a tight argument in Europe, it becomes banned. You can't expose people to a carcinogen or an endocrine disruptor because you don't know where the harm starts. So for children, for vulnerable people, you don't know. There is, you know, this, the idea that you can expose them to X, you know, milligrams per kilogram and then cancer starts is considered by the Europeans as not particularly protective of public health. So, you know, and so then we say, well, what is the, you know, exposure that you can have? So the exposure that we can have is 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight a day, Oscar, and that's come from a 1993 Monsanto study by Atkinson et al. That was never published. So, you know, that 1 milligram per kilogram, it fails children, it fails a pregnant mum, it It's really problematic. And we're just like the APVMA. We've got one retired toxicologist to do this review, the cancer review that they did, Wayne Temple. And that was, you know, that was meant to contest the work of 16 scientists working at the WHO IARC.
You asked a question earlier on, Oscar, about work safe and public health. Now, it is quite clear work safe, and I have got OIA documents that say this is nothing to do with work safe. They will not intervene because of a potential harm to be caused. But more important, in 2015, after our weed management advisory had in fact commissioned a human health risk assess of the use of glyphosate on our road, and IARC came out with their determination, Auckland Transport, who was then doing the roadside use of glyphosate, quite frankly, I think they panicked. They went to Auckland Public Health Protection Services and asked them, would they please endorse their use of glyphosate use on the roadways? And three times in a whole series of conversations, which went on over weeks, three times they went back to Public Health Protection Services and said, please, please, will you let us, you know, will you endorse our use of glyphosate? They basically refused to, and their response finally was that it was not in their remit to do this, but more important, they actually outlined in there the numbers, the hundreds of calls that have been made about glyphosate reactions from the public. And after that, all this documentation and all these reports disappeared from Auckland Transport's website. They didn't really want it to be known that the Public Health Protection Services refused to endorse their use.
And I want to return to the discussion around road corridors and a little bit later in reference to Christchurch City Council. I wanted to return to a comment made earlier by Jody around we don't know where harm starts. Now, with the description or the view that if the label is followed, there won't be any harm, we obviously have kind of a short-termism where there's a whole heap of things that can't follow a label. Soil cannot read a label, etc. So there's harm for the environment that will potentially occur, if I'm not mistaken. And in the operation and spraying of glyphosates or application of glyphosates, is there that potential for it to spread from where they applied? So even if the label is followed in one specific area, is there that potential either from runoff or from aerial distribution for the chemical to find its way somewhere else, be that into waterways or be that into soils where it's perhaps not meant to be and cause harm there?
Yep. So with soil, it depends upon, and Murph can explain this way better than me, but it depends on the soil's biochemical characteristics, you know, whether the soil is loam or clay or silt. It depends on the climate, whether it's really cold and there's not much microbial activity or whether it's warmer. It depends on whether it's rained, you know, a day after the glyphosate was sprayed. And so what they're seeing, so in Otago groundwater, glyphosate is in Otago groundwater. So we assume that's because it's colder down there. And when it's colder, you know, there is less ability for all the bacteria to sort of degrade glyphosate. So they have found, of course, glyphosate in the estuaries around Auckland in, I think, one study that they've done. So we've done so little monitoring of glyphosate in the environment. Waikato is possibly the best regional council. They've done the most work, I think. So it depends on the temperature and the climate. So for example, when... And glyphosate also, so the actual active ingredient, once you add glyphosate to the formulation includes heavy metals and it includes, you know, petroleum distillate byproducts. So that's also going out into the environment. And so you've got the cadmium and the lead and those heavy metals that are being added to the environment from the glyphosate through the glyphosate formulation. And there's a study I can send you that confirms that. So what they found, though, so you think glyphosate, It's got phosphate in it. So if it goes into a stream that's already got a lot of runoff from like fertilizers and other phosphates, the stream's going to say, oh yeah, I can't do anything with you. I won't break you down because I'm full of all this other phosphate. Whereas if you've got a stream that's a beautiful natural stream and, you know, lots of slippery natural surfaces that are with a healthy, you know, microbiome in the stream, it'll break glyphosate down much more quickly. So it just depends on so many different factors. And this is why, you know, wouldn't it be great if they were, you know, testing the soil in Auckland to understand the breakdown and understand if the, you know, the cadmium and the lead were staying in that soil. And because of, I'm sure you've talked about the fact that we've got resistance, the other chemicals in that tank mix formulation, which is a common thing to do, will have different half-lives, different time it takes for half to break down.
If we are releasing chemicals without the full knowledge of where they are going and intention of how they react with other natural elements, is that essentially another form of chemical pollution?
The General Court of the European Union in 2019 found that all emissions into the there is an overriding public good, and all emissions into the environment should be declared. And so they turned around and said, actually, you've got to declare the formulation ingredients in glyphosate-based herbicides. It should not be, what's the word for it, a commercially advantageous secret, because, you know, they've got their secret mixture. So it's pollution. There's nothing less than that those mixtures constitute pollution.
And is that the same for soil, Strauss?
I can't comment on the soils, as Jody says, that this gets into some very complicated biochemistry and also biology in terms of the degradation. So I simply can't comment on that one. What I was going to do, come back to your question about other harms if these products are used as directed. I take the bigger picture looking at this. The aim of all herbicides is to eliminate plants. And it's a kind of a bit like the Lorax speaking for the trees. Plants are our friends. They're not our enemies. These things are fixing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, putting it into the soil. They're helping to reduce environmental harms. By eliminating plants, we are increasing environmental harm, full stop. So again, it's coming back to that real and actual harm. We should only eliminate vegetation when it's absolutely necessary, regardless of how we do it, full stop, whether it's a chemical or a physical or whatever technique.
Oscar, if people are really interested in chemicals in freshwater and those mixture effects, there's a paper by the Soil and Health Association and Physicians and Scientists for Global Responsibility on the freshwater policy process and how the freshwater policy process has avoided consideration of environmental chemicals for 9 years. And the great scientists that have been invited to be part of that policy processes have been ecologists. They haven't been scientists that have expertise in environmental chemicals. So it's been really hard to pull environmental chemicals into that discussion. So that's a 2019 paper that can be found easily through either the Soil and Health Association or psgr.org.nz.
The intention of glyphosate or a herbicide is to remove a plant. So its intention is to do damage to the point of death, to remove it from its environment. How do we look at something that has this intention in relation to our human body, especially in an urban environment or even in a rural environment where we are in proximity to such a chemical?
I would like to ask the question. We have a 60 kilogram male that has a strong, healthy life. We have a young boy that has asthma and allergies. We have a young girl that has an immunodeficiency problem. We have a pregnant mother with a daughter inside her, and inside that daughter is the egg cell of that daughter's future baby. So three generations are exposed at once. Yet we don't have a government that actually can look at the vulnerability and use the precautionary principle to start saying, when is this a risk that is unethical and immoral?
Precautionary principle is something that we've heard a bit. Can someone explain what the precautionary principle is?
The precautionary principle is essentially the opposite of risk management. Risk management assumes something is safe until enough evidence is shown that it's harmful. The precautionary principle flips that on its head. It says if we have enough reason to believe something may be harmful, we will assume it is harmful until it is proved to be safe. And so Jody's talked quite a lot about the European Union. The precautionary principle now underpins a considerable amount of European legislation around stuff such as agrochemicals, the pesticides, for exactly this reason.
And just adding to that, Catherine Eons-Magalan, who's a scholar at Wellington University, has written an amazing paper on permitting poison and the precautionary principle. And she explains that New Zealand, our EPA and HESNO are really unable to place the precautionary principle at a high level. It's in the legislation. It's down as a, oh, well, we can consider economic issues and then we can consider, you know, social issues and then maybe we can consider the precautionary principle and then we can stop thinking about that and then we can think about other things. Whereas European legislation has it at a very high level, as Murph has said. So we tended to dismiss the precautionary principle. The other thing that's really interesting in decision-making that New Zealand needs to look at is when you have decision-making by a public authority for public benefit, it tends to be, what are the odds? Is it more likely it's going to be dangerous? So is it 52%? Shall we make a decision looking at that probability? Whereas scientific probability might be, well, it's, 95% chance. So you get the impression that the authorities keep feeling that they have to have a very strong interpretation of risk, when in fact, actually, our public law isn't necessarily saying it's like that.
I think it's worth pointing out that we've just come to level one in the last last couple of days, and that New Zealand had no problem with the current leadership taking the precautionary principle in regards to the COVID. In fact, we were world leaders on this, and it seems, a couple of deaths, a number of deaths, were too many deaths for this country to tolerate. And yet they happen, those deaths are very visible, they happen in front of you in a particular time frame, which makes it intolerable. But what we're actually talking about is a slow dis-ease occurring in people and in the ecosystem as a result of this this material being used with massive regularity and massive quantities. And so I think it's time for a reframe of what is tolerable.
I want to return to our current scenario or situation within what I think is fair to label a human health crisis in a little bit. I want to return also to perhaps some of the more practical applications or the actual application of glyphosates. There are active plans within weed management, I think, and forgive me if I'm wrong on this, to mix fatty acids with glyphosates as a future solution or as a solution that's already in play. Firstly, what are fatty acids? Secondly, is it a good idea to mix the two? And thirdly, Christchurch City Council, at least, has refused to use fatty acids on their road corridors due to their known runoff into waterways. So what does that say about the effect of this combination or of fatty acids alone to the rest of our urban ecosystems?
Okay, so the fatty acid herbicides are some of the organically certified herbicides that are available, and they're extracted or derived from plant oil. So they're all derived from vegetable oils. And unlike the rest, to use a broad term, of the herbicides, the rest of the herbicides are biochemical in action, as Jody noted around glyphosate. Glyphosate attacks and disables a particular amino acid pathway that exists in plants, and by disabling that, that kills the weed. So most herbicides attack biochemistry. The fatty acid herbicides are essentially acids. They're a biophysical herbicide, and they destroy the cell's walls, the structures that make up plants, and this causes the plants to effectively collapse. So they're quite different from the rest of the herbicides in their operation. There's also a common misunderstanding that something that is certified for use in organic systems is safe. This isn't true. Organic certification simply says that there are no synthetic or artificial materials in the compound being used. So this is why, to be an organic herbicide, it has to be derived from a natural product. In this case, vegetable oils. The other organic herbicide is vinegar. It has the same effect. It just basically is the same as sulfuric acid. And we're not talking vinegar as in the chip shop. We're talking industrial vinegar that if you dip your hand in it, you will not have a hand afterwards. So one of the things with the fatty acid herbicides, they're derived from a naturally occurring material, therefore they're allowed in organic, but they are actually very, very toxic. You know, so right up there with a whole load of other, you know, disinfectants, household disinfectants. So these are, organic doesn't necessarily mean something is safe for the environment.
And Murph, I don't believe they have the same persistence as your synthetic herbicides.
That I can't comment on. I'm not entirely sure what data exists around these organic herbicides because they are so different from the other herbicides and what regulatory framework they've been approved for use under.
Yeah, I saw something on pelargonic, you know, fatty acid herbicides, and I think it was claiming it was less than 10 days. But again, it comes down to what is the science being used to do the testing, what are the labs, you know, is this replicable? There's so little science around. So what we see is you know, if you look at the, I think it's an NZTA paper from the South Island, because you're seeing glyphosate resistance, you'll see terbutalazine. Terbutalazine is a groundwater contaminant. It's from the triazine endocrine disrupting herbicide group. You're also seeing metsulfuron methyl. Now, glyphosate and metsulfuron methyl aren't tested in, you know, traditional drinking water. They're not a product of what we don't look for that in our normal drinking water regulations. So that they sort of slide under all these sort of regulations that are meant to protect us. So that these formulations come together plus an organosilicons. And organosilicons are harmful to insects and bees, so they'll be harmful to aquatic insects. So then you've got not only the additive 1 + 2 + 3, you've got the synergistic. So you've got different ways these are toxic. They know that formulations are generally more toxic, but of course we don't have a place, you know, in New Zealand we don't have an area of science that is paid to do this work. This is why you get lay people talking about this. It's a failure of the, you know, our governance systems to provide those sort of scientific institutions that can do this work.
So I'll just make some technical comments about tank mixing. So tank mixing is where two or more chemicals are mixed together in the same solution for application, principally used in agriculture, but also used in other situations such as urban weed control here. There are quite detailed recommendations, and typically mostly recommendations, about what can and cannot be tank mixed, because these are all quite active chemicals. And if you put the two chemicals together in your tank that are not compatible, you can have some very undesirable effects indeed, from just stuff gumming up your nozzles to you know, really quite unfortunate kind of effects. So there are known recommendations for what can and cannot be mixed together. And this is not only herbicides, but whether you can mix a herbicide and another kind of product together, you know, a fungicide. You wouldn't be putting a herbicide and a fungicide together normally, but a fungicide and insecticide, for example, you may be wishing to mix together. What hasn't been done, though, these fatty acid herbicides and the biochemical herbicides really have not been put together before. So to me, this is something that should be studied in more detail. What's also going on with mixing herbicides from what are called different modes of action, so they have different ways of attacking the plant chemistry. This is a known method for trying to reduce the chance of resistance occurring. If you apply the same herbicide multiple times to the same area containing vegetation, that creates a very strong evolutionary selection pressure for those weeds to become resistant to that herbicide. By alternating between herbicides or by mixing herbicides with different modes of action, that can reduce the risk of resistance evolving in a species. But as Jody has outlined, many of the other herbicides that are being, not the fatty acids, but the other herbicides being tank mixed with glyphosate actually have a higher risk profile than glyphosate does. Yeah. So this is not necessarily from an environmental or a human health perspective a good thing. This is quite likely to be a bad thing.
This is a rather dumb science question on my behalf. But say a plant develops resistance to a chemical, can you increase the concentration or strength of that chemical to a point where that organism no longer has a resistance? And what does it mean when you are then inserting perhaps a chemical with a higher toxicity rate into the environment? Does that pose more future risks, and does it still do the actual job that it was set out to do?
So that is a very good question, and there is a vast amount of science being done in this area. Resistance, plants can become resistant in multiple different ways. To avoid a lot of the jargon, some of it is dose related, so the amount of active ingredient that you apply to the plant, and if you increase the dose, you will then kill the plant. In other instances, the plants become completely resistant to the herbicide because, for example, again using glyphosate, they simply change the chemistry, their biochemistry. So the glyphosate kind of herbicides and the biochemistry is a bit like a key and a lock. They change the shape of the lock, so the herbicide key will not go in there anymore. So you could, for those kinds of, that kind of resistance, you could literally get a straight bottle of glyphosate from the farm supplier, tip it over the plant, and nothing will happen.
As an example, check out Agapanthus. So, you know, Agapanthus is and that's resistant. And I just want to show you, I've shown this before, but the crucial is this new herbicide, it's glyphosate. And if you look at it, it's 600 grams a litre. Now, we just used to have glyphosate at, say, 300 grams a litre, but they've increased the strength. But they've also tripled, you know, the other ingredients in it. They've tripled the surfactant technology, which is what breaks down the outer leaf layer. You know, they've tripled the salt. So they're trying to deal with this resistance through this product. So what is the toxicity of this product for our kids?
On a similar note, what then happens to the, again, my science terms aren't sharp, in plants, the vitamin value or the health of those surrounding plants that perhaps aren't being targeted?
So what they're finding is that I don't know if you've talked about glyphosate being a chelator, and it binds minerals in the soil. So what they're finding that there is corn wilt in the US, and that is because, you know, the glyphosate is binding these like magnesium and these minerals, and so they don't go up into the plant, you know. So you're getting the absence of nutrients. So you're finding that a lot of these minerals just aren't in the food that is glyphosate is sprayed in those crops.
So it's an antibiotic. So it's actually affecting the microbes, and we know that soil health, plant health, our capacity to draw down is based on healthy plants. So when you actually are compromising the environment where you are killing microbes as collateral damage, that is, it can only degrade that soil system.
Anecdotally, we've seen changes in the soil health from repeated applications of glyphosate used for weed control, where they also had the need to use a lot of fungicide because the chelating effect was binding the calcium and the magnesium, which is essential for cell wall strength. And if you have poor cell wall strength, then your plants are more prone to getting fungus. So there was this cyclical effect of spraying the ground, killing the microorganism activity, binding up the magnesium, calcium, getting fungus, spraying with fungus, and they were just trapped in a chemical cycle. As soon as you transition out of that to other methods of weed control and start to build up soil health, what we've seen is a reduction in the need for the fungicides as well, and a return to plant vigor. So typically when we are talking with customers who are just wanting to move away from chemicals because of personal exposure, but also they're just seeing sub-lethal effects, in their vines, in their berries, and in their trees. It just gets down to that repeated application of herbicides really killing the soil microorganism activity, and that has that ongoing effect onto the plant material that they're actually trying to protect.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.